You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Tuesday, March 28th, 2017. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live. Steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, David Roberts of Vox.com on Donald Trump and the rise of tribal epistemology. Also on the program today, well, just about everything is tribal epistemology on the program today. Will tax cuts for the rich be the next fail for the Trump administration?
No.
Or will it be the government shutdown?
Yeah, okay.
Meanwhile, the Gorsuch filibuster gaining steam. Will Mitch McConnell hit that nuke switch? One thing Donald Trump can do is destroy the Obama-era climate change efforts. And they're all but gone after the latest executive order. Meanwhile, the Trump administration and Devin Nunes trying to stop Sally Yates from testifying in front of his own committee.
It would be unfair.
As the Intel Committee is on the brink of collapse as an institution.
Sorry, guys.
Say on the other side of the brink.
Got to reschedule that hearing because I've got a meeting later.
Peace protests in Yemen as the U.S. considers escalating its war there. This on the in the wake of the largest civilian bombing in a decade, more, in Mosul. Meanwhile, foreign students say no thanks to U.S. colleges. Wow, what a surprise. Wonder why they would do that. American higher education to become significantly dumber and less interesting, and fortunately, more expensive.
Don't we love the poorly educated?
And then, I don't know, Kushner meets with Russian bankers. We don't know. Apparently, the Russians say it was a different meeting than Kushner does. And maybe there's video of it. Maybe they're all freaking out. Who knows? I honestly, folks, having trouble following the Nancy Drew mysteries that are going on at the White House right now. And, man, I'll tell you something. I think, what is the over-under on how many days before Devin Nunes gets a Medal of Freedom from Trump?
Well on his way.
I mean, at one point, I mean, right, we're going to see some pardons. He's just going to start issuing pardons just in case. I mean, you know, they didn't do anything. Nobody did anything. In fact, I'm going to give me a pardon too. Let's just say everybody's going
to
get a pardon.
It's business. You need to look ahead, you little Jew. That's what you do. You plan. I'll take a fucking pardon.
I mean, Devin Nunes is, at one point, you know, I'm really honestly having trouble sort of absorbing it, and so I'm paying a little more attention to the, what's going on legislatively, and make no mistake, though, what is happening with Nunes, with Kushner, what is happening with this guy Epstein, and the fact that it's quite clear to me that Nunes was tipping off the White House about something. And I imagine it's not a coincidence he was tipping them off after he heard from the FBI. I don't know if it was because there were people still working at the White House. He went on television the other day, made a real point of saying, like, look, there's no one at the White House now working today who, I mean, you know, I think the guy is an idiot, but he's also, he's like that guy in Fargo. He's like Jerry Lundegaarden.
Wait, he's like the guy sounds like Reince Priebus. This is the second person who's Fargoing it.
It's one lie to cover another lie to cover something, and they realize it's snowballing on some level.
I went to the White House one gosh darn time. Okay, three times.
I think that Nunes must have like either realized or saw some reporting that said he was at the White House. I mean, because theoretically, right, you shouldn't be able to just sneak into the White House. And maybe he tried to. And maybe he was, I don't know, hanging out like on the lawn. I mean, who knows what he was doing? Maybe it was that guy. Wasn't there a report of somebody who...
Yeah. Nunes got drunk and was naked on the lawn. It's all right. He wasn't telling us about anything.
We'll catch up with this. I mean, hopefully before the... Before Comey arrests him, do we see any further reporting as to what Comey was doing at the White House last week?
No.
Oh,
not that I've seen, but not good.
Not good. Well, or good.
Well, good from our perspective.
Yes. But we will dig into this later in the program. But this was pretty funny, and we just wanted to play this clip before. We have Dave Roberts on. This is Kylie McEnany. Kaylee McEnany. I'm sorry. I never get her name right. But you know what? Who cares? Honestly. Yeah.
Conjugal visit?
The... What? here's what it takes to be able to become hired as a CNN contributor, ladies and gentlemen. Just an ability to put words together in a sentence and not notice the absolute disbelief of the contributors who are sitting to the left and right of you. Here it is.
You had President Obama, who after the, I believe it was the beheading of Daniel Pearl, spoke to how upset he was about that, then rushed off to a golf game. I think when we're in a state of war, when we're in a state of mourning, you should take time off from the golf course.
Okay, so she's apparently defending Donald Trump's record-breaking golf pace at this point. And also, the already, not pace, has broken the records that Obama had for travel in 2 months, 3 months of the year. Not even, I guess it's been 2 months, right? It's only been since the 20th. It's about 2.5 months.
It's been about 67 days.
67 days, and he's already spent more on travel because he's going back and forth to Mar-a-Lago. Where it turns out, fortunately for the Trumps, there's no record. Secret Service don't keep a record of who comes to visit Donald Trump there. So that makes it a little bit easier for, you know, Joey Nosox to come and visit and not get any problems.
That's right.
Peter Beinart's look on his face is one of his pure astonishment, because there's a little bit of problem with Kaylee McEnany's math. Daniel Pearl was a reporter for the Wall Street Journal. Al-Qaeda in Iraq, I believe
Pakistan.
It was. Pakistan released a video, basically, of his beheading. And they forced him to... basically renounce America beforehand
and Judaism.
And according to McEnany, President Obama said it's really horrible and then went and played golf. Now, there's a couple of problems with that assertion. One is President Obama was in the Illinois State Senate. So he would not be president of the United States at that time. He was not president of the United States until 6 years later, in 2008, or actually 2009, so maybe 7 years later. And at that time, I don't recall him addressing it. He may have, but in passing. But so she just made that up.
Sam, can I just interject? I have to interrupt afternoon prayers here for a second. How the hell did that bitch know I went off and played golf after he got beheaded?
Yep.
She have a wiretap on me back in 2002? How can you be tracking me as a member of the Illinois State Senate? It's a sacred process. Kelly McEnany is a bad or sick person.
Sick.
Well, wow, Akbar.
There she is. I mean, just throw out facts. I mean, I'm sure if she had a chance to correct herself, my guess would she would say, well, he did something like that.
Yes. Something like that. I learned over my friend. I said, boy, whew. Quite the video there. All right, let's go hit the links. Allahu Akbar.
Regardless, I have a question for, I think, Michael. There were extensive negotiations on behalf of Daniel Pearl, so it would have been by the time the public, the video was released to the public, it would have been the end of a long process.
I don't know how long that process was. I don't know. I mean, they tried, but regardless, right. I mean, he was, yeah.
Not that anyone would go golfing, but
hey, folks, Stamps. I'm sorry, I gotta get to Dave. We're 12:14. Yeah, Stamps.
Stamps.
I'm sorry.
We have a format of the show. I'm not sure if people pick up on that. Stamps.com saves you time and money, which you can use to just save money or grow your business. The beauty of Stamps.com, I can mail any letter, any package, using just my computer and printer, and the mailman picks it up. You can avoid the hassles of leaving your home or your office, having to go to the post office, by mailing everything from postcards to envelopes to packages, domestic or international. Create your Stamps account in minutes online. No equipment to lease, no long-term commitments. Click, print, mail, you're done. And unlike the post office, Stamps.com never closes. You can print postage for letters or packages at your convenience 24/7, 7 days a week. It's convenient, it's easy, reliable, and it's on your schedule. They'll send you a digital scale, which automatically calculates the exact postage. They'll even help you decide the best class of mail based on your needs. No need to lease an expensive postage meter. Right now, you too can enjoy Stamps service with a special offer that includes a 4-week trial plus postage and a digital scale without any long-term commitments. Folks, go to Stamps.com, click on the microphone at the top of the homepage, and type in my code MajorityReport. That's Stamps.com, enter MajorityReport. Stamps.com. You'll never have to go to the post office again. You'll never have to leave your house or your business. If I could build a tunnel, I guess there is. It's
every
the subway,
time you do this ad, I always am reminded of why you love this service so much.
Yeah, it's just
you don't have to go anywhere. And there's stamps, and there's digital, and it's great. Big government survivalist Sam.
There you go. All right, folks, going to take a quick break. When we come back, Dave Roberts.
Through a clear as crystal Gothenburg morning. Removing his suit jacket, loosening his tie. Wiping the sweat from his neck and the sleep from his eye. It's 1997, the last morning of August. At the corner of 7-Eleven, he hears the broadcast. Another saint is lost. Lady dies, returned to stardust. He listens to the tragic news, followed by the top 10 tunes. Will Smith, Puff Daddy, On the other side of the street, he passes Cafe Java.
We are back, Sam Cedar, on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome back to the program David Roberts. He is the climate and energy writer for Vox.com. And although the climate suffered another setback today, or at the hands of Donald Trump's executive order pen, we're here to talk about something that I guess is, let me ask you this. Why is this a topic? And I know you've been writing about this for years, but why this notion of tribal epistemology? In fact, also define that for us. But why is this topic so important to you? I mean, I know it's related, obviously, to your climate work.
Sure. Well, what I mean by tribal epistemology is just this phenomenon of people evaluating information, you know, not based on whether it's true as we think of true, like corresponding to some larger understanding of the world, but just whether it's good for your team or not, or whether it's echoed by leaders on your team or not. And so it's a phenomenon that everybody's, you know, it's a fancy term, but it's a phenomenon that I think everybody's familiar with these days, because you see it playing out on the internet all around you. Everybody's sort of constructing their own realities that support what they already think, you know, picking and choosing the news that they heed. I've been fascinated with it for a long time. I mean, mainly because I think this sort of asymmetry between the left and the right on this particular point is probably the most important phenomenon for understanding American politics today, and I feel like it's been, I feel like people dance around it. I feel like people don't really address, especially in the mainstream media, I feel like people don't really grapple with it, honestly. So I just wanted to lay it out as sort of clearly and completely as possible. And of course, like in my own area, I cover climate change, so the right wing's sort of insularity and denial of reality in a lot of ways was kind of, climate was kind of the test run, you know, for a lot of these sort of wacky epistemic closure that they're suffering. Climate was kind of the canary in the coal mine for that stuff.
It's funny, your piece is entitled Donald Trump and the Rise of Tribal Epistemology. I think the only thing I would correct with the piece is just I would change rise to victory.
final victory. That's better. It's been going on for a long time.
Well, I mean, that it's interesting about the climate, though, because you can track, because you start your piece with Limbaugh and the so-called climate gate. But, you know, we know Limbaugh back in the early 90s, and he started, I guess, in 88 in this version of his show. He was the OG Foster Gate and Travel Gate guy. Like, he...
Oh, sure.
He was the one who was talking about Vince Foster, you know, go in the park, you know, getting his body dragged to the park. And,
yep.
But I guess climate was the first thing that broke out in such a, because there was always some of this filtering in from the right, but climate was the first one where the tentacles wrapped itself around the entire conservative brain, wasn't it?
Yeah, and on a large, wide ranging issue too. Like, there's plenty of sort of individual craziness that you can trace before them, but this is sort of like, I guess, climate is where it became really naked and obvious, right? Like, the sort of contrast between the clear consensus of the world's scientists and the conservative movement just became so clear so quickly. And you know, in normal circumstances, when you clarify to someone that the overwhelming consensus of scientists disagrees with them, they're obliged to change their mind, right? Like, that's how we think it works. That's why that's how we think of science. Like, science is, whatever our political disagreements, ultimately, in the end, we defer to the best scientific knowledge. That's how we naively think of it. So this was, you know, an example of the conservatives just saying, yes, we see your consensus of the world's scientists, and we don't care. Screw you, we still don't believe it. So it's just kind of a really, it's a very glaring example. It's hard, there's no way to talk your way around it.
You know, it just occurs to me that in one of the things, you know, back in the Air America days, Stephen Sherrill and I had written a book that was, you know, a more sort of, I mean, supposed to be funny. And I think it was sort of funny, but it was, we were talking about how those on the right, on the margins, were taking over the party apparatus. And I remember, I think it was a quote from Gertrude Himmelfarb, who was, who's Bill Kristol's mom, I think, who was talking about attacking science as a way of decoupling people from the ability to have arguments that can be resolved by a sort of a neutral arbiter in some
fashion.
Yeah,
they attack neutral arbiters. I mean, it's no, this is one of the things I wanted to do with the piece, is we have these sort of like examples here and there of they attack this neutral arbiter and they attack this neutral arbiter, you know, and I talked about Newt Gingrich back in 1995 shutting down the Office of Technology and Assessment in the Congress, which was just meant to be a neutral arbiter of information for Congress people to give them non-biased information. And so one of the things I wanted to do with the piece is sort of draw all those together and say it's no coincidence that this movement is going after one neutral arbiter after another. It's the nature of this movement to be hostile to neutral arbiters as such. Like, that's one of the things I wanted to do, is kind of show that this is a pattern. It's not just individual judgments.
And they're attacking a structure first, and the what those structures are presenting is secondary, right? I mean, because presumably that technology office and the CBO presumably comes up with numbers that are favorable to a conservative argument in one time or another, but better to get rid of it a whole cloth.
Yes, I think their instinct is to see things as us versus them, right? Our tribe versus their tribe. And so this idea that there could be this third party, this referee above this disagreement, sort of making calls on it, you know, judging one side or the other as having violated some rule, that is offensive to them. I think when they see something that looks like that, I think their instinct is just to think this is just the other team in disguise, right? They're pretending to be referees here. They're pretending that science is unbiased. They're pretending that media is unbiased, whatever. But really, it's just the left in disguise. It's the left trying to win its battle through other means, right? They're just sort of like, I don't think, it's not, they're suspicious of the notion of neutral arbiters, but I almost think it's deeper than that. I almost think they just don't believe in them. They don't believe in the possibility of them. So when they see someone pretending to be one, like, for instance, a journalist pretending to, you know, a journalist claiming to be neutral and unbiased, they're just immediately suspicious. They're just immediately like, what bias is he hiding, right? That's where their mind goes.
And I think there's also a question as to, I mean, in my experience in dealing with some of these people, and I'm thinking about someone we've had on this program, we haven't talked about in a long time, but so-called Indie Mike, who is a complete independent. He doesn't care. He just listens to facts from both sides. He'll listen to Ann Coulter and to Brett Baer, both of them, and there's a truth in the middle. But his big contention, and I hear this, is that, like, there's no facts. You have a fact. It's not really a fact. There's no facts.
Right. Well, I mean, this is one of the more hilarious kind of ironies of all this. You know, you remember we lived through the 80s and 90s. You remember the right wing railing against cultural relativism in the academy. This idea that, you know, it's all just cultures and there's no one truth, there's no one right way, whatever. They hated that, but now they have created that environment, right? That's what they've created, is this total postmodernism that we're struggling through right now. The thing is, on a philosophical level, I think it's true that we probably can't identify transcendent facts that are independent of any human judgment, et cetera, et cetera. All we have is our best judgment, right? All we have is our best consensus. So that's why we set up society. That's why we gather people together and say, okay, you're going to run an institution. We're going to call it science. You're going to use these procedures. You're going to have certain rules you follow. You're going to examine the knowledge you produce. You're going to have to replicate your experiments. You're going to go through peer review. We set up this institution to gather and vet knowledge so that we can come to the best conclusion we can, right? The best judgment we can. That's what we call a fact, is just something that's been verified by the fact verifiers we've appointed as a society. But if you decide we're not going to trust those fact gatherers and verifiers, we're not going to trust their conclusions, then you are in a situation, right, where there are no facts. If you've rejected the institutions whose job it is to certify what's a fact and what isn't, if you reject them, then you're right. There are no facts. There's my facts and your facts. And that seems to be what they want. Because when politics becomes that, it's just a contest of power, right? There's no persuasion. There's no talking with someone. If you don't share a bedrock of factual information, you can't even have a coherent argument. So it just becomes a power struggle.
Well, and I also think, though, I also think that the scenario that you're creating, my facts and your facts, right? That there is no, society doesn't come together to create institutions that provide some type of neutral arbitration. That to me seems very consistent with a vaguely libertarian worldview, right? I mean, I've spoke to libertarians who are like, well, we don't really need courts. You would have a court, I would have a court, and they would adjudicate, and we don't need to have, you know, government regulation. We can have private entities that provide a seal of approval on, you know, this doctor is approved by Moody's, right? They get a AAA rating.
Yeah,
like the whole idea is that you can
Yelp ratings.
It is literally to them a marketplace of ideas.
Yeah,
like you pay for the ideas, and if I support them, they win.
Well, I think one interesting thing that's happening as Trump sort of openly assaults American institutions and norms is that a lot of people, and I include people on the right and on the left in this, are rediscovering a kind of small c conservative fondness or respect for these basic institutions and norms of American life, right? So you're seeing tensions within the right between the people who are leaning in the kind of Trump burn it all down direction and people who are like, you know what, like, it's nice having courts that both sides respect. It's nice having scientific fact that both sides respect. It seems to like enable a society to go on. And it's happening on the left too. It's sort of, you know, you see all these new subscriptions to the Washington Post and
New York Times.
And I was talking with someone in the EPA the other day, and she's like, most of my career has been people yelling at me, but for the last few months, I get people coming up to me and just thanking me spontaneously and hugging me. I feel like there's a recognition happening on both sides that these institutions and norms that we spent decades, in some case centuries, building up are worth defending. It's not, you know, burn it all down is, as a casual sentiment, is one thing, but when you start seeing the things that hold us together as a society fraying, you're like, you know, start to have a little bit more respect for those things.
Well, that is from the sort of old school blogger days in the early aughts. That was the difference between the sort of left blogosphere and right blogosphere media critiques, right? Which is the left would critique the New York Times and the Washington Post as being with an aim to reforming it, whereas the right would be like, we're going to, you know, make these people toxic. I mean, this is right. I mean, it's just the difference is that now, like, one of those, like, war bloggers, essentially, for lack of a better term, is now the president of the United States.
I don't even know if you could say the war blogger is the president so much as you're sort of like average war blogger reader is, right. is president.
Yes,
now.
Commenter. The guy who like yeah, exactly. they still favorite tolerate.
I mean, I think there's really something to that. I mean, I think, you know, originally this incredibly long piece I wrote was even incredibly longer. But at one point I had a section there about, you know, sometimes people are talking about, say, well, you know, Trump's populism and Sanders' populism, you know, have these sort of some themes in common. Maybe there is like common cause to be made between these two groups, and there's a populist movement to be had. And what I was saying is that hope is forlorn because Sanders populists do critique our institutions and norms with an eye toward reform, with an eye towards strengthening them and making them fairer and better, making them take more account of the perspective of poor and marginalized people, you know, because I think Sanders left populists recognize that the weak and vulnerable are the ones who benefit from having these structures and institutions in place. They restrain the powerful. But whereas Trump's populists, I think, are come from a more, you know, burn it down perspective. They don't want to reform or heal these institutions. They want to burn them down. They don't like the direction that American democracy has taken for the last, you know, century. They want to start over. So I think those are just that's a fundamental difference between right populism and left populism that makes any sort of hope of alliance forlorn.
Along those lines, you cite studies by Will Wilkinson of the Nicholson, I think it is, Institute.
Niskanen.
Niskanen. I mean, I've been mispronouncing that guy's name for, I think, probably a decade. But he was a former head of the Cato Institute, but famously said the problem with cutting taxes the way that we did during the Reagan administration is it actually encourages more spending because you're putting it on a credit card. Essentially, I think he said somewhere like around 15% of GDP. But nevertheless, longtime listeners will know I was sort of obsessed with that guy for a while. Tell us about the study that Will Wilkinson has done, because I think part of the story of the gerrymandering is also part of this sorting.
Right, right. Well, just to clarify, Will Wilkinson is a researcher at Niskanen Center, which, by the way, I think is doing a lot of really interesting work these days. There's not a lot of interesting stuff happening on the right, but there is some, and they're home to a lot of it. Just to clarify, he didn't do the study. He was just describing a set of studies. But the idea is this sorting that America has gone through, you know, which I think at this point probably listeners to your program are familiar with. You know, we're sorting ourselves by race and by class, by... And part of what Wilkinson found looking into these studies is this sorting even goes down kind of to the level of personality or character or values. We're really sorting ourselves into two countries. And one of the things that social science tells us is as a society gets wealthier, its values tend to drift. I guess the easiest way to describe it is left, towards secular humanism, towards self-expression, towards kind of a post-materialist culture, kind of the lefty culture of cities, urbanism. That's what tends to happen to societies as they get wealthier. But if they get poorer, they tend to go the opposite direction, towards traditionalism, towards kind of putting up walls, towards suspicion of outsiders, towards survival values. Any tribe or culture that's in threat will tend to double down on these values and rules that it views as holding it together. So that's what survival value means. So anyway, Wilkinson's point is just the U.S. is kind of dividing into two countries. It's sorting itself into two countries. We have this kind of growing urban centers, which are prospering economically. And there are plenty, obviously, of poor people within those urban centers, but as a culture, as regions, those centers are on the rise. And then we have this rural and ex-urban culture where all this sorting over time has left this culture very homogeneously kind of white and Christian and conservative, and not just conservative by ideology, but conservative by personality, you know, sort of averse to social change, very traditionalist. We've got these two countries now, basically, in the United States, and they're drifting, as the sorting continues, they're drifting farther and farther apart, and sort of that's what you saw with the Trump election, is just looked like two countries that no longer have hardly anything in common, and one kind of like came out of nowhere and booted the other one out of power. But, you know, it's like a lot of people are just discovering this other country now. But Wilkinson's whole point is there's no this economic division has led to a division in values and division in ideology and even personality, and is just getting worse and worse, and it's being made worse by the sort of sorting of information that we see, you know, on Facebook and elsewhere. It's been made worse by right-wing media came to this culture that was increasingly isolated and increasingly homogenous, and just deliberately exacerbated all its fears and paranoias, and just pushed it down the road it was already going down, this road of traditionalism, until it's become kind of brittle and tribal and completely suspicious and completely distrustful of any information that comes from outside their tribe anymore. So they've just kind of been cut off from the mainstream of American society and are now kind of drifting out to Alpha Centauri, where you hear things like, oh, a majority of them think that Democrats are running a child trafficking ring out of a pizza restaurant. And this kind of stuff has been going on so long that we're just like, oh, yeah, that sounds about right. Millions of people think this super wacky conspiracy theory. It's just normal. It's just day-to-day in America now. We don't even blink anymore at these kind of things. But the fact that millions of people could come to believe something like that seems to indicate that something's gone wrong, that we're not really communicating with each other anymore.
Well, all right, so we have this depolarization, and you're right, obviously, I think, which people understand that it is, it has been asymmetric, that the right has been departing the center, I guess. And I don't even know, I mean, both politically and in terms of like sort of this neutral narrative that includes things like the Clintons didn't kill Vince Foster, all the way to Podesta and Clinton weren't using pizza words as a code for pedophile parties. That there, you know, in those two tracks, the polarization has been asymmetric. They have been drifting, if not running, at an accelerated rate, it seems to me, from what we consider the center. And you talk about the dilemma that the media faces, in that the media, and I would argue it's not just the media. I mean, maybe, you know, but it seems to me that a lot of people on the Democratic side, the liberal side, the left of center side, also did not accept how deeply polarized this we've become, and how asymmetric it's become. And I would say this is true not just of the media, but I would even say there's some evidence that the Clinton, even the Clinton campaign, relied on Republicans to say, like, no way are we going to elect Donald
Absolutely.
Trump. And that was a wrong bet, too.
Their entire bet was that there's a floor on partisanship, right? There's some level you can sink to where even partisanship won't carry you there. You know what I mean? And the Clintons were like, well, maybe self-admitted serial sexual assault. Surely that's the floor, right? Surely partisanship is not stronger than our mutual aversion to sexual assault. Surely, right? Mm-hmm. And you're absolutely right. They underestimated the strength of polarization. And the left has done it over and over and over again. And the media has done it over and over again. No matter how strong you think it is, it's always even stronger. And that's the Trump election, right? I mean, that's what, right. That's one of the reasons I think the media missed it, is I think the mainstream media has been, in a lot of ways, just in denial about what's going on the right. And I think that's one of the reasons that they that they missed this. They thought, well, surely our consensual shared information universe now contains information that this guy serially sexually assaulted women, his foundation's a scam, he's cheated all these people. You know, surely based on this information, we're all going to come to the same conclusion. And once again, polarization showed that there just isn't the same information. Well, there's two universes.
To be fair, you probably end up voting for a serial murderer who had Parkinson's. So,
and a pedo ring.
Right, exactly.
Owner.
I mean, well, so, okay. So, but moving on from that, I mean, look, it's your vote if that's the judgment you want to make.
We all make compromises.
Right. Exactly. All right. So we have this situation. I mean, do you think, I mean, this is, and you say there's basically like two challenges that the media needs to face in this situation, is that they can't be neutral. Just talk about how the media deals with this at this point.
Sure, sure. The dilemma, as I would describe it, and this is the whole heart of the piece, and this is kind of the tricky part. There are political fights, policy fights, ideological fights between the two parties, and the mainstream media today, I think, probably rightly sees itself as not taking sides in those disputes. Right? It just reports on the arguments. It is a neutral referee of those arguments. Right? It just makes sure that neither side is lying or making things up, but otherwise does not take a position on these, what you might call normal political issues, like, say, the right size of, I don't know, Social Security, whatever. And then there's this larger question of the field of play itself on which political battles are playing out is defined and structured by this set of institutions and norms, the Constitution, you know, state governments, and not just legal rules, but also informal norms of conduct toward one another, which are also sort of those informal rules are enforced by civil society, by journalism, et cetera. So the question for journalism is, you want to be neutral in these political disputes, but I don't think journalism can be neutral toward a political movement that is attempting to degrade and destroy those institutions and norms that make democratic life possible, and they make journalism possible. Journalism, as it's conceived in the U.S., is not possible if we descend into total postmodernism and every side has their own truth, and there's no such thing as an arbiter of truth anymore. If you're in that situation, total postmodern fog, then independent journalism becomes pointless and inert. So journalism has to take a side in that fight. It can't be neutral toward a political movement that wants to destroy the things that make it possible, right? So this is the dilemma: is how do you maintain your reputation of being fair towards both sides while also working to defend kind of the basic institutions and norms that make the whole thing possible? Because right now, the threat towards those institutions and norms is highly asymmetric, right? It's the right that's after them. It's the right that's working to destroy them explicitly at this point, not even implicitly anymore, explicitly seeking to destroy these third-party institutions and norms that hold us together. So the question for journalism is, how can you fight that without just looking like you're fighting Trump on behalf of Democrats, right? How can you fight to defend institutions and norms without looking like you've just chosen a side politically, right? That's the dilemma that journalism has faced in America over and over and over again, right? Because the right has been stomping on norms for years.
But looking like to whom? Like, you're saying, how can you fight, how can you protect those norms that are being attacked by Trump, including the media, right? I mean, refers to them as the opposition party. How can you do that without looking like you are doing it on behalf of the Democrats? So here's the question.
Right.
to whom, who, when you say looking like, to whom?
Right, right. Well, that's it. I mean, well, this is, I mean, this is the reason that the few unfortunate souls who read all the way to the end of my piece will discover that I really have no answer to this. I have no answer to this dilemma. I have no easy answer. I mean, obviously, your hardcore Trump supporters are going to see any critique of Trump or anything he does as the left fighting the right, the two tribes, right? Us versus them. There's no way you're going to move them, at least not anytime soon. I think we just have to believe that that hardcore of truly, of those people who are truly epistemically closed off, lost to us, is reasonably small, and there's lots of people on the fringe or on the margins who aren't really committed one way or the other, and who theoretically could be won back to trusting some sort of mainstream institutions. But exactly how that works, Sam, I honestly wish I had a better answer. It's like a universal acid that dissolves any attempt to solve the problem, right? Because the minute you come up with a new institution or a new rule or a new anything,
it's subject to the same dynamic
as left.
I guess the question is, like, who looking like to whom? And maybe it's just a question of even instead of worrying about what they look like to whom, but rather just sort of like obliterate that sort of self-awareness. Now, the part of the problem is then you ruin the institution. I mean, that's the thing is that, like, I don't know. It was funny. You mentioned Ziegler, John Ziegler. And
the war blogger in question.
Yes, and I remember David Foster Wallace's piece. And Ziegler, I think, even went on to do a pro-Sarah Palin thing back in... I think he did like a documentary about her or something early on. I can't remember. I mean, I just remember Ziegler from the radio days. And the idea that he is sort of like lamenting this. You had that guy from Wisconsin, Charlie, what's his face?
Sykes,
who now apparently, I guess, is an MSNBC contributor.
Hilarious.
Well, which is where he was lamenting it. But, you know, their instinct seems more or less still the same. You know, once they get past the fact that they've been rejected by their own, they sort of revert to mean, it seems to me.
Yeah, well, I mean, tribalism runs deep, right? But it's still notable, it seems to me, that these guys who have been just marinating in tribalism for years, even they are starting to realize, like, there is it's possible to go too far down this road. Like, if you become completely immune from any outside fact-checking or restraint or any outside information, it's not just that you end up believing a bunch of horseshit, but it's also that you can't behave strategically or tactically. You can't be good at politics if you're in a fog of misinformation. So I feel like even some people on the right have realized that if we keep going down this road, the conservative movement is going to end up being a completely closed off, completely white, completely Christian, you know, sort of cult almost that only talks to itself. And that's not a recipe for political, you know, even if it's just purely practical and instrumental considerations here, that's just not good politics.
Well, except for the fact that they dominate our entire except for the fact that it's been incredibly successful for them.
Yes, and that is disheartening.
I don't know Wisconsin radio, but I bet that Charlie Sykes slot is filled now by somebody far more odious than he is. And
there's demand for it.
And yeah, and you know, it's an ongoing dilemma, and I don't, you know, it's going to be interesting. Like, you know, I mean, one thing we've seen, like, CNN, right, has been, I think, very consistently belligerent with the administration, except for that one brief moment where after his speech, there was a real palpable sense coming from CNN, like a huge sigh of relief, like, oh, finally, we're back to normal.
Finally and back to normal.
It lasted only about 12, 14 hours. But
they wanted to be normal. I mean, one of the things that's funny about Trump is the U.S. political media was so ripe for being co-opted. It would have been so easy for him to come in and just toss a few bones to the media.
Oh my God.
And just kiss a little butt, and he could have easily co-opted the entire institution. The only way he could have fired them up the way he has is just by being consistently belligerent a-hole towards them from the minute he walked in. And now he's like revived their institutional pride, and now they're actually like care about themselves as media again, which I think is a 100% positive development. But it's just like another strategic blunder from the world headquarters of strategic blundering.
All right. Well, since lastly, let me ask you this: since you can't provide us any answers after that piece, what do you think happens if? I mean, this is more just to sort of get a sense of how much has that changed really with the press. I mean, let's assume for a moment that we don't have an insane guy. Obviously, I'm not a doctor, so I can't make this. But I think he's clearly, like you say, incapable of controlling himself enough to even do what is like so obviously in his best interest. But I think like a guy like Mike Pence is not that way. I think he is almost pathologically the opposite. I mean, he's willing to go on Donald Trump's ticket because. Here was a guy who was at 40% in his home state. He was basically done. He was just going to be going to work at Heritage, probably. What if he becomes president? I mean, do we not see that incredible sigh of relief by the press? Like, oh, we're back to just full-on climate denial and the notion that gay people can be reformed.
But at least they wear the right suits and say the right words on TV, right?
Yeah.
They lie the way they're supposed to lie. That was the problem with Donald Trump, is not that he lied, but just that he didn't do it with the sort of affect and sort of verbal tics that you're supposed to use when you lie to cable news people, right? They're fine with lying. They just don't like the sort of aggressively open, kind of brutish lying. It was more of an aesthetic objection. But, you know, this whole thing about what if there's a competent Trump, I definitely get that worry, but I draw your attention to the last week or two where it wasn't like this healthcare business, it wasn't just Trump who screwed the pooch on that in 50 different ways. Just because Paul Ryan can string a coherent sentence together and wears ties that are the proper length, we've sort of taken him as competent by contrast with Trump. Same thing with Pence.
Pence is an idiot.
He's an idiot. He's an unpopular idiot. He was a terrible governor. There's no particular evidence that he would be some ruthlessly effective operator in contrast to Trump. The incompetence and insularity on that side goes all the way down, I think. So
I think you're
really
right.
Like blundering is
blundering
is the order of the day. Blundering is the thing to be scared of, right? Incompetence and blundering.
I think you're right, but I think, you know, we also have to, you know, sort of keep in mind that suddenly you have, I mean, I think a lot of what we're seeing in terms of the resistance, as it were, is motivated by Trump. And it's unclear how much of this awareness is going to remain when Trump goes away, because certainly on the left, you know, or the center liberal left throughout that spectrum, there is a tendency to like, oh, phew, the emergency's over. Let's go back to, watching what's on, you know, some cool Netflix show or whatever it is.
Yeah.
I think there's part of it. Part of it is also, you know, Obamacare became much more popular in the past 3 months than it's ever been. And that's a function of a media environment which is telling those stories where I don't know if they would have told those stories if it was only Paul Ryan. And I would also add that Paul Ryan's original plan was repeal and then wait for replace. And it was Donald Trump the next day comes out after Paul Ryan makes that clear and says, we're going to do it at the same time. Maybe it'll be a week. Maybe it'll be an hour. Maybe it'll be a day. And then he screwed the pooch for Ryan in that point. So I don't know. I have no doubt that Paul Ryan and Mike Pence are not nearly as bright as they have been made out to be in the past. But I don't think that they need to.
Yeah, that's a low bar.
Yeah.
Well, that's the problem is like every successive Republican president pushes the bar down lower and lower. So our sort of judgment of what counts as like a competent alternative also is going lower and lower. I mean, I think you're right that the big central question about Trump at this point is he's been a shock to the system, right? Like he's been shocked. He's woken up civil society. He's woken up journalism to a certain extent. He's woken up a lot of people just to be political who never thought of themselves that way. How much of that will endure, right? How much of that consciousness will endure, that sort of that consciousness on the left of like, oh, like modern developed democracy is pretty cool. Maybe we should work to preserve it and not allow it to decline into autocracy. Like all that organization that Indivisible is doing, and all this trauma in the Republican Party, is any of it going to last, or is any of it going to make an enduring change? Or alternatively, in 2020, you get some bland centrist Democrat elected, and everybody, like you say, just breathes a sigh of relief and goes right back to the kind of kabuki dance we were doing before Trump. And yep. That is the $6 million question. I really have I mean, I've gotten out of the prediction business, Sam, after I published not one but two pieces last year with the headline, Donald Trump will never be president. I thought, you know, I'm going to
Well, if you're going to do one, you might as well do two, right?
I wanted to make it very clear that I had no doubt on that that matter.
You're not alone in having made that prediction, I can assure you.
So no more predictions from me. But
well, Dave,
that is a big question.
Thank you so much. We will link to the piece at Vox.com. Always a pleasure. Next time we can talk about how a lot of this may be just a foregone conclusion because the inevitability of climate change.
We're all doomed anyway.
Putting all this under assault. So,
awesome.
All right. Thanks, man. I appreciate it.
All right. Talk to you later,
Sam. Bye-bye. We're
all going to die.
Well.
Bye, Dave. Tom Collins, anyone?
So we were just talking about hopefully in 2020 we won't see that bland centrist Democrat.
Tim Kaine.
But right, exactly. But apparently, right before I was going to go into my... Things are looking pretty good on the Gorsuch front.
Sorry to be the bearer of bad news. And sorry on behalf of Matt, because it's his senator.
Matt's personal senator, Senator Heidi Heitkamp from North Dakota. She's a centrist Democrat.
Oh, yeah.
As opposed to one of those conservative Democrats like Heidi Heitkamp.
She's just all that means is she just like less of a Negro lover.
Honestly, like, who's a conservative Democrat?
Heidi Heitkamp, Joe Manchin.
Is Joe Manchin to the right of Heidi Heitkamp?
I actually couldn't answer that. Is there any difference in their political profile? I don't know.
Has she ever shot up a piece of legislation with a
No, I haven't seen her fire a weapon before.
Okay, well, maybe Joe Manchin. She is from North Dakota. How big did North Dakota go for Trump?
Oh, pretty significant, like maybe 60%, maybe north of that probably.
Okay. So
Heitkamp was the only senator that 538 got wrong in 2012. She beat Rick Berg for that Senate seat. Everyone was expecting it to go Republican.
She is up for re-election, and she is now saying that she will not participate in a filibuster. She's not saying that she'll vote for him, but she's saying that he deserves an up or down vote. Now, the Democrats can afford to lose 8 people. So she's one of them. there were 10 people that conservatives groups, I should say, had earmarked for spending money to pressure them to vote for Gorsuch, or at the very least, against a filibuster. You'll recall that Republicans control 52 seats. Apparently, Senator Chris Coons was the guy, Democrat, who was trying to broker a deal so that there would be no filibuster and no destruction of the filibuster.
Cuck.
That fell apart. Indeed.
Cuck.
Democrats on the Judiciary Committee were able to delay a vote on Gorsuch for 1 week. So the vote will happen maybe by April 7th. Or I should say the committee vote, I think, happens. They're trying to get it on Monday and then later in the week get it in front of the full Senate. This is a fairly rushed procedure because the Senate is going to recess for a couple of weeks. But so you had conservative outspending Democrats 20-1 on pro-Gorsuch ads in 10 Democratic seats, I should say, not necessarily states. Heitkamp, Manchin, Donnelly, seven other Democrats who are facing re-election next year, including Casey from Pennsylvania and Bill Nelson, and both those guys said they're going to vote against a Gorsuch, and I think Casey said he would support
Casey
a filibuster.
Casey says he's going to support a filibuster.
So they're down to the wire, you know, guys like Donnelly, John Tester. And John Tester has said he will not vote for cloture and against Gorsuch. He knows he can't get away with that. So
he's going to be synchronized either way.
So that he could be the guy, right?
Yeah.
You could lose the that would be seven.
Yeah.
So continuing to send, call. In fact, you can go to calloutgorsuch.com. CalloutGorsuch.com. And that will send you into a system that will help you make phone calls to your senators to put pressure on them to support a filibuster. I mean, and then that's going to put pressure on Mitch McConnell to bust the filibuster. Some people, you know, nobody really knows how much of an appetite amongst the Republican caucus there is to get rid of the filibuster. On one hand, there are institutionalists there, and they know this is it. You get rid of the filibuster, and somebody wrote me like, well, can't they just reinstitute it? Well, they can, but, I mean, when the Democrats take power, they'll just get rid of it. And, yeah, the genie's out of the bottle. The ship has sailed. The cake is baked.
Sayonara.
The bed is
into the cake.
The bed has been shat.
The fat lady sang.
So, and personally, I think it's time. Get rid of the filibuster for Supreme Court justices. Let's have people own this stuff. And there's, you know, on one hand, there's not that much of an appetite for it. On the other hand, 20% of the people who voted for Donald Trump, 20%, their number one issue was the Supreme Court. And I can tell you, those 20% are not whatever percent you think is available to a left economic message. It's not those same people.
Not at all.
Those people are on different ends of that spectrum. Those are the hardcore Republican in Republican district, no swing state, Christian right, so-called Christian right. Christianists, if you would call it, crusaders. And
crusaders.
Calloutgorsuch.com. Place your calls to your senators, folks. All right, we're going to take a break and go into the fun half. But first, a reminder. This program relies on your membership. You can become a member today in moments. You can enjoy the full archives of the show. Go back, listen to great writers, authors, speakers, fair comedians.
Libertarians.
Libertarians in our archives. Go back and get some of our deep archive shows. You know, we have a lot of new listeners now who don't realize that for our members, and we should do this in April, and we can actually go back and recycle some, I think, because, you know, people haven't heard it for 6 or 7 years. Deep archive shows that Janine and I did on the first version of the Majority Report, and you wouldn't believe some of the guests we would get in those days. That was the biggest radio that I interviewed Eddie Vedder.
You're talking Jerry Springer.
Jerry Springer.
I'm just messing with you.
We did interview Jerry
Springer.
Yeah,
I know, but I wasn't. He might not have been the most exciting person you got back in the day.
No. Just about anybody you could imagine, honestly. Gore Vidal, Robert Altman.
Hello, Mr. Vidal.
He came in
quite a bit. I know. I remember. I listened.
Who else? Who else? Matt, you've listened through a lot of those.
Well, we had Lewis Lapham on.
Lewis Lapham. Last time. That was recent, though,
right? There's a few Bernie ones people might be interested in.
Plenty of Bernie ones. Gosh, though. I mean, people that we don't hear from or would imagine would be on. I don't know. Colbert came on. He co-hosted at one point, I think.
That's not on the...
With Janine.
That's not on the spreadsheet. I haven't seen
Colbert. Are you sure? Colbert is definitely on there somewhere. And... Oh, we should play some of like the Saddam that, what's his face? Gosh darn it. Fred. I can't even remember. What?
Armisen?
Yes. Fred Armisen. Play Saddam Hussein.
That's
and
funny.
We call in.
That's good.
And he sounded like the guy from the Rolling Stones, Keith Richards. I can't think of anything today.
Keith Richards,
folks,
Saddam Hussein.
Join themajoritireport.com. And you get all that I was just talking about and more. Well, not more, but that's a lot.
First time Obama called you a Jew.
Every day, you get an extra hour of material. Join themajorityreport.com. And also justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. In fact, wait 2 or 3 days on that because we got a huge, huge Just Coffee promo coming up. And if you buy crap from Amazon or Jet.com, please do so through our link at MajorityReportKickback.com. We get a kickback. You don't notice no difference. April 1st is right around the corner. In fact, the anniversary of the first Majority Report, 13-year anniversary, is coming up in like 2 days. All right, we're going to take a quick break. 646-257-3920. We get a lot of sound to get to. See you in the fun app.